Welcome to The Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Sarah. I don't want to start it with Sarah.
I almost started singing. The time warp. Yeah. That was like the biggest like middle school dance song when I was in seventh grade.
I can't let that go. So listeners, welcome to the Paleo View. And you're so welcome for jumping in and getting, like, there's so many bloopers in this episode already.
Oh my gosh.
And I couldn't let that one go. I just had to make sure it was at the beginning. So there's a little teaser of what's to come at the end of the show.
I mean, here's the secret is that we're actually pre-recording this episode because you're about to go on like an epic spring vacation. By the time this show actually airs, I think you're going to be like almost at my house, on your way to my house.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. So because you're traveling and I'm actually speaking at a conference coming up this weekend, we just went like, we need to record this in advance. So if everyone remembers last week that I was kind of punchy and like super like sugared out on the ice cream dessert, like it's still the same day. I'm still sugared out. Or something. Maybe like podcasting is just my favorite thing today.
Can you see my eye roll from DC?
Like, I really could. I could like feel it. It had a physical weight to it, that particular eye roll.
It is amazing to me that our friendship has lasted this long with how positive and enthusiastic you are and how sardonic and like can't even deal with life I am.
I mean, opposites attract or something.
Something. I have tried to be a lot more positive like in the last year. It's something I'm actively working on. But I'm never going to stop being a sarcastic jokester.
I was going to say, I've learned how to be sarcastic. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I employ sarcasm now in my day-to-day life. It does. I mean, it helps that I have like an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old. So sarcasm is like, it hits now. Like they get it. So, and every once in a while they'll ask me, they'll double check. Mom, was that sarcasm? Yes, it was. It's great. But do you want to share a little bit about your like epic trip that's coming up?
Sure. So I think I talked about this at Christmas time because this is the gift that the boys got from Santa for gifting experiences over things. So we're going on our spring break cruise to the Caribbean.
Oh, so jealous.
And we will have been on it when you hear this. And one of the things that was really important to me is that we disconnect. We are unplugging. We're not getting Wi-Fi in the ship. So it's been an interesting week preparing for that. So that's why you're having a time warp today. But also in the office, in my, you know, side hustle beauty counter business. I have a team of almost 200 people that I'm working with to get squared away. And I'm trying to do my best so that all of the stuff that people might need from me while we're swimming with dolphins and stingrays and what else are we doing? We're bobsledding in Jamaica. Can I just tell you how much I heart my children that that's the excursion that they chose? And snorkeling in the Bahamas.
Though, hang on. That's just epic.
Right? I gave them a whole bunch of options, and the minute that I said Jamaican bobsled, they were like, yep. Like, all three of them were like, no other questions asked. Like, that's what we're doing. So,
do they know any of the, like, Jamaican bobsled Olympic team history?
Yes, because over the Olympics, it was like
the first female Jamaican bobsled team, and then how they like their coach ended up not getting recognized as a coach, so she left, but like she was the one responsible for the bobsled, so they had like a Jamaican beer company had to like buy them a new bobsled last minute. I'm just saying, I maybe follow the Olympics a little bit.
Well, maybe you can give them extra history when we come visit you, because right around this podcasting time we'll be or have recently been to. I honestly don't even understand what's happening in time span.
I think when this podcast goes live, you're like almost at my house. I think it's like 2 days before you actually arrive when this podcast goes live.
Yeah. I think that I'm like the last day of the cruise when this comes out. But yeah, so part of the excursion is going through some sort of like history museum of it. So the boys can totally exchange facts with you.
They'll like educate me. They'll exactly. give me details.
And you guys
great.
Can talk about the history. But the cool thing is it's like a track that they set up specifically to go around the curves of a rainforest. So you're like at the top of a rainforest coming down. You'd like take this trolley all the way up. And then they specifically built it to go around trees so as not to disturb nature.
So much better than ziplining. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm
like excited for you. And I'm trying to figure out if I can just like hop in on this cruise like last minute.
Well, did I tell you that I almost tried to cancel this cruise because I found out about a month ago that they do cruises to Costa Rica and you can do an excursion to the sloth sanctuary. And I was a little upset.
Someone likes sloths a lot.
Just a little bit. I was a little upset that I didn't know that that existed when I was choosing a cruise. So the boys have all agreed that we will do that another year. Like they've promised me that it'll happen. So we're continuing with this cruise this year. But yeah, they're super excited. They've never been out of the country before. They all had to get passports to go, and we're going to disconnect and spend a lot of quality time together. It's a whole week long cruise. It's 7 days. So it's quite a long time to be stuck with each other on a boat.
No Wi-Fi.
And then when we get off the boat, we're going to do the Kennedy Space Center, which is right there at Port Canaveral, which is where our cruise takes off from. And then come visit you. We're going to have Easter dinner at your house and go to a science museum and do fun stuff before we come home.
Yeah, I'm excited. My kids are excited. It's going to be really fun. I just have to think about what to cook still. Like, weirdly, because of the time warp, I haven't come up with a menu in the last hour.
Yeah, if we weren't busy doing bloopers about, like, the random stuff that we talked about in between the shows, we could have been planning a food menu, yeah.
What about, like, a Kahlua pork? That's totally an easy one to just make a ton of.
Cole loves pineapple, so.
Yeah, I do, too. I'm all about the pineapple. See, that would be super easy to make enough for 9 people. Like, just make a ton. Do, like, a whole, like, 5-pound head of cabbage.
Can you do ambrosia salad? It's what Matt calls 5-cup salad. It's, like, marshmallows, coconut, and fruit. Have you ever had that?
I have had it. I've never made it.
Maybe we can make that, because I know that's one of Matt's favorites.
I'm writing it down.
I'm trying to think of what else. What kind of meat? Are we going to do ham? Yeah,
you said Kahlua pork. Well, I was going to say, if we do a Kahlua pork, we can pretend it's ham, but it's like way better than ham.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, and then clearly we need a spring vegetable.
Yeah, something green.
Right?
And springy.
Cabbage is a winter vegetable, so it doesn't count.
All right. Well, we can plan our menu. This is super boring for our listeners. What are we going to talk about? Tell me about your trip, by the way, which was like 2 weeks ago for us.
Actually, funnily enough, it feels like 2 weeks ago, even though I left a week ago and I only, like, it was a 3-day field trip. So I think we mentioned this like 2 podcasts ago, thanks to the time warp. I chaperoned my daughter's 5th grade sleepaway field trip. We went to an environmental sciences education center on the Georgia coast, and we spent an entire day on Cumberland Island. And it was just the most like amazing experience. It was like long days, exhausting, like trying to keep exhausted kids behaving well is a super challenge. And I mean, that's the chaperone's job at these things, that and make sure that, you know, nobody gets lost. It was just like the curriculum was amazing. And I'm the like super nerd chaperone who's like in the front row with the kids, petting the alligator, like with the kids, and like waiting for the kids to ask their questions. But then I ask my questions, like, I just hang on. What was that Jacobson apparatus thing? So I just like, I super nerd. I joined the super secret plankton club with the kids. I was the chaperone who was chosen for the like crazy initiation ritual that like, if there's a teacher who's never gone on this field trip before, they always make the teacher do that ritual. But because they're all of the teachers who went this year had gone before, it was a chaperone. And out of like 25 chaperones, I was the one who got picked. And it was super fun and amazing. So I don't mind at all the fact that, you know, the entire group of 100 people played a practical joke on me. It was fine. But I loved it. And it was, you know, it was exhausting, you know, like super long days. I still even feel like I'm still like I don't want to get out of bed in the morning. Like I'm still catching up on sleep a little bit. But I just loved it. It was a great bonding experience with my daughter. And with her friends too. Like I'm the chaperone who, this is my second sleepaway field trip that I've chaperoned, but I do a lot of volunteer work in the school. So I'm always the chaperone who like will, give the kids a hug when they're feeling homesick. I've got all the first aid supplies on me all the time. So I'm the one who like, I always have the band-aids, I always have the extra water, but then I also like, don't let them get away with anything. So I'm also like, I'm like the strict lovey chaperone, and the kids always just love that. They like, they love boundaries and hugs in the same person. So, so it's just such a great bonding experience with all of those kids. Like those are all kids. I had a lot of kids in my cabin this year who were in my cabin for the fourth grade sleepaway field trip that I chaperoned last year. So it was like really fun. And like, they were like, wait, you know, Mrs. Ballantyne's going to be, none of them call me Dr. Ballantyne, weirdly. Mrs. Ballantyne's going to be in our cabin. Yay. And they're just like super excited. And then that makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. So if you can't tell by how much I'm rambling about how wonderful it was a really great experience. And I can't wait to do it again in 3 years with my other daughter.
Oh, I love your little like knowledge group, you know, like that. Being empowered with information and being around nerds is cool. Like, because it is. Like, being smart is cool, and knowing stuff and having fun and all that kind of stuff, which I feel like, I don't know if it was just me or if it's like a time frame difference, but I know when I was a teenager, it was cool to not know things. Like, like, you know what I mean? Like, I just was like, whatever, you know, like, I'm saying a lot of and likes, so clearly I'm not getting my point across.
No, I think actually you're like exactly getting your point across, because that's how we talked when we were teenagers.
Yeah.
I wasn't cool as a teenager, because I was a nerd. Now nerds can be cool, which is really great. Actually, what was really neat about it too, is because I was like in there, like a dirty shirt. I was like, yeah, I'm going to hold the turtle and, you know, hold the snakes and like all of that great stuff. And I'm going to, you know, like I was like all over it. And it meant that the other chaperones that were in my day group probably would have held back. Were like also, well, you know, if there were two dad chaperones in my group. So I was like, well, if the mom chaperone's touching the snakes, I guess I better touch the snakes. Like it was like a little bit of, you know, okay, well, you know, peer pressure. But I think what was cool about that was it just meant that like everybody had this amazing experience. And I just find the curriculum was a mix of environmental sciences and sort of botany, taxonomy, and then mixed with history, which was just a really, really cool mix. So, I thought it was fantastic. This particular, education center they like when they open up their bookings, they're like in a couple hours, they're like booked for the whole year, and that schools come like constantly. Like there was, as we were leaving, the next bus tour was pulling in. So, you know, obviously they've got a good thing going, but it was really phenomenal. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. So are we doing something today? Or are we just having fun? Cause I feel like having fun could be its own show, but also
it could be its own show, except that we actually have a really cool question and no segue to this question whatsoever from anything that we've talked about. I can throw it over to you, Segue Queen. How did you stay gluten-free on your trip? I don't know. I don't know what your segue is.
I think sometimes just saying there's no segue is perfectly no segue. Okay.
We have a question from Gina, and it's sort of a follow-up to a post that I had posted, I think like 2 weeks ago, something relatively recent. And when I read it, I just went like, oh yeah, this is a great topic because it gives me the opportunity. I don't know if you're going to join me in this one, Stacey, to kind of take a step away from paleo dogma. So that to me was like really exciting to be able to be like, hey, I'm going to say something that you might not hear other people say in the paleo community. So why don't I read this question and then I'll say my super controversial thing.
Oh, now you've got even me excited.
Right? So Gina writes, hi ladies. Since late last year, I have started listening to your podcast and I love is in all caps. I just have to say that. All the information you both share, I've gone back and listened to so many old podcasts. My question for you is, late last year, I started seeing a registered dietitian to help lose weight. I'm 20 pounds overweight, and I am active and eating, for the most part, a clean diet. I have not adopted a paleo diet as I eat very little meat protein. I am obsessed with eating healthy, reading labels, and trying to feed my family as healthful as possible. I had a Vibrant Wellness sensitivity test done and had 3 positive foods and 9 moderate foods. Gluten-containing grains and gluten-free grains were among that list. With this information, I had the gene test done for celiac and I tested positive for HLA-DQ8. And then also further had a wheat zoomer test done that came back showing some high risk for some of these panels. I was told I have leaky gut and to avoid gluten for life. My husband and sister were also tested and both carry a celiac gene. I just read the post on the celiac gene and I'm still confused. Do I need to avoid gluten forever? Can I have some every once in a while? I've never noticed any symptoms that bothered me. When on vacation recently, I did have pasta that wasn't gluten-free. I didn't feel great after, but that had nothing that would stop me from eating it again. I feel less bloated, but not seeing weight loss. I don't do well with being told not to have something. Will I develop celiac disease if I continue to eat gluten? Are my kids at risk since my husband and I both carry this gene? I know you both talk that you and your family are gluten-free. I just don't know that I can do this 100% of the time. Is this really going to affect my body if we continue to allow some gluten in our diet? Any help or suggestions would be greatly appreciated.
So I feel like I know what you're going to say, but I'm just going to go ahead and say that if it were me and I had anything come back that I had an allergy to it, or hereditary disposition to celiac, I would not eat gluten. And I know we're going to talk into how to avoid it and, you know, how to kind of get over those feels. But I think, for me, I also am a control freak. I don't like someone telling me what I can or cannot do, which is why I tell myself it's the choice that I'm making because I want to be there for my kids when I'm older and I don't want to have colon cancer. But I also have celiac. I have high white blood cell count when I consume gluten and more recently have developed anaphylactic reaction to it. So it's kind of a non-starter for me. It's a little bit different.
Yes, you definitely don't have a choice. I want to take a step backwards and say that I do not subscribe to the dogmatic paleo approach of everyone must be 100% gluten-free all the time. When you look at genetic adaptation since agriculture. And there has been some. So this whole like soundbite of eating the way, you know, our bodies that are adapted to eat, we haven't adapted to Neolithic foods. It's an oversimplification of the fact. And there actually have been some really neat studies that have looked at genetic adaptations since the advent of agriculture. There was actually a really interesting study that I explain in detail in chapter 25 in Paleo Principles, where they did genetic testing from teeth, and they had samples everywhere from 300 BC to 6500 BC. And so it was, you know, right at the beginning of agriculture in that area. So they were all from West Eurasia, so sort of Western Europe and Eastern – wait, hang on. Western – you know that area. That area. Eastern Europe, Western Asia.
You know I don't know that area because I'm geographically dyslexic.
It's Eastern Europe and Western Asia is the area. So they basically had their earliest samples were like right from like the earliest evidence of agriculture and animal husbandry. And they followed it up to 300 BC. And what they were able to do was compare the genes in these different samples over time. And they were able to isolate a dozen areas of genetic adaptation due to the change. Now, this is not just the change in diet, but the change in lifestyle that comes with agriculture, because suddenly we stop being nomadic cultures, right? There's a lot of other changes that happen. And what was really interesting in this paper is they then went and looked at those genes, like, what do those genes do? And some of them we can identify, like, oh, this is the gene for this. So lactase persistence is the most well-known example of, you know, this is – here's the gene for lactase persistence. So what that is milk has lactose, the sugar lactose in it. And before animal husbandry and dairy being introduced to the human diet, humans only produced lactase, the enzyme that breaks down lactose, until we were about 5 years old, which was the traditional age of weaning. And actually, we see this even in a lot of traditional cultures still, hunter-gatherer cultures. Children are typically not weaned until they're fourth year of life at the earliest. So they're breastfed a lot longer than we are, and they're breastfeeding concurrently with eating solids. But they produce this enzyme lactase up until about age five. And what happened with the introduction of, you know, cows, dairy, sheep's dairy, you know, the other animal dairy, goat dairy into our diets over the last few thousand years is we have genetically adapted to continue to produce this enzyme, this lactase enzyme, into adulthood, at least a large percentage of us. So it depends on exactly what your cultural heritage is. So it reflects actually how long ago dairy was added to your diet. So, for example, people of European descent, about 95% of us have lactase persistence, and only 5% of us are lactose intolerant. But there's some sort of Asian and African cultural backgrounds in which there's as little as 10% of people who have lactase persistent, because dairy was introduced to those diets much, much later. So that is one, you know, really well understood area of genetic adaptation since agriculture. There's some other ones that are well, sort of at least fairly well understood, some adaptations that relate to fatty acid metabolism. There's one that causes a decrease serum triglyceride levels, which is an interesting adaptation to dietary changes. There's one that relates to vitamin D levels. It's probably relating to variations in vitamin D exposure that we have that didn't exist sort of pre-agriculture. And what's really interesting is the celiac genes, HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8, are two of these genetic adaptations to the advent of agriculture. It's thought that these celiac risk genes are more like a piggyback. They're an accidental genetic change that was the result of another change that actually happened. And it was actually related to protect against something called ergothionine deficiency. So even though we don't fully understand the role of ergothionine in human health, it's a naturally occurring sort of antioxidant amino acid that our bodies can't produce. And so it's thought that as our diets changed, we weren't getting enough ergothionine. So we had this genetic adaptation to preserve it. And that in that change in our genes, we also accidentally created these two celiac risk genes, HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8. So what's really interesting to me about this is this data implies that we've had at least partial adaptation to Neolithic foods, right, to agriculture. But there's some really important things there. Like, we are not genetically adapted to a nutrient void diet. There's several of the points of genetic adaptation that we don't understand what those genes do. So there's definitely incomplete understanding of how we've adapted to Neolithic foods and whether or not those adaptations are, you know, good, or like HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8, they have like a flip side to that coin. And I think it's really interesting to look at that information in terms of adapting to inflammatory compounds. So, you know, I look at that and I go, there's genetic adaptation. I can't look at this information and say everybody needs to be gluten-free all of the time. I don't think that's true. Gluten-containing foods are not nutrient-dense foods. There are ways that gluten gets into the body that happens in everyone that doesn't require a genetic predisposition. We now have data linking gluten to obesity, that gluten, or at least protein fragments of gluten, get into the body intact and bind with receptors in fat cells and in the liver that influence our metabolism and slow it down to make us gain weight and not be able to access stored energy. So there's a definitive link now between gluten and weight gain. You know, we know that there's other inflammatory compounds in wheat, like amylase trypsin inhibitors, which may be the cause, the actual real cause behind non-celiac gluten sensitivity. It might actually not be gluten. It might be what's called ATIs, amylase trypsin inhibitors. There's wheat germ agglutinin, which is so good at getting across the gut barrier intact that it's been investigated as a drug delivery molecule, and it's highly, highly inflammatory, which is why scientists were blowing the whistle on why it would be a terrible drug delivery molecule. So it's, I'm not making the case for wheat being a good food, but that being said, there's sort of a difference between even occasional consumption is going to erode your health versus I'm going to recover really quickly from occasional consumption, and as long, or even, you know, semi-regular consumption, and as long as these other sort of things that we know are absolute truths when it comes to diet, like nutrient sufficiency, we get all of the nutrients that our bodies need. As long as these other things that we know are really important inputs to health, like sleep and stress and exercise, as long as those things are dialed in, you know, I think we've got really good evidence from just people walking around the world who are very, very healthy, who eat gluten, that, you know, there are people who certainly can tolerate this suboptimal food and do not necessarily need to avoid it. That all being said, Gina knows that she has a HLA-DQ8. And I think it's really important to talk a little bit about the implications of gluten consumption in non-celiacs with celiac risk genes, because that is a really, really important, important concept to wrap our heads around. And I think it really is at the heart of Gina's question.
So because, yeah. Before we jump into that, I want to just address the idea that not everyone is gluten intolerant. I do not disagree with that. We've actually mentioned it here on the show before. But what I will say is that if we're being honest with each other, like, let's be real here. Just like last week, we talked about how gluten-free treats sneak in and we're not really honest with ourselves about the benefit that they have to our health. And I would put alcohol in that same category. Like, is that glass of wine or that martini that I'm having a problem? Does it have gluten for me? No. But is it helping my health? No. Right? Like, there are foods like that. There is, I know a lot of people in my life, and honestly, I will tell you that quite a few of them are leaders in the paleo movement who eat gluten on special occasions or when they're traveling or whatever the case may be. And they just acknowledge that, that's their time to do that and that they know they won't feel their best, but they're also not going to be debilitated or anaphylactic or bedridden the way that might happen to some other people. So the idea that, there's no adverse reaction, however, is what I want to address, because I think that this is really important. We talk all the time about gluten can affect people in a multitude of ways. It is not just a stomach ache. It is not just bloating. There are things like inflammation that can show on your skin with acne, sinuses, headaches, migraines, joint pain. There are so many things that go into what any sort of food that you're intolerant to can do to your system when your system is fighting with a food that it does not agree with, essentially. And so I can tell you from experience that recently I was with someone who was paleo, and they normally in their own home, if they were going to eat gluten, it would be like sprouted Ezekiel bread very, very occasionally. It's not a regular occurrence. But while they were traveling, they ate gluten at almost every meal. And these people, let's call them person A and person B. Person B did not consume the gluten-containing foods. And these both people who normally would have strong immune systems were exposed to a virus. And one of the people got the virus and the other person did not. And so those are the kinds of things that I would encourage you to think about as well as we're talking about what might be for you or what might not be for you. And when you choose to expose yourself, specifically when you're traveling, like if I were going to do it, it would honestly not be when I was traveling. I know that that feels like it's the right time because you want to enjoy yourself at a meal out and you want to relax and do blah, blah, blah. You want to have a beer on the beach, but your immune system is going to be compromised when you're exposed to more germs than ever. And it's just my personal thought that that wouldn't be the time that I would want to expose myself if I could make that choice. Obviously it's not an option for me, but I personally feel like the time to experiment, like recently I chose to continue to eat a food that had nightshades in it because I had asked for something without nightshades. I ate the first bite. I knew I had already eaten nightshades the minute it was in my mouth. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to eat this and see what happens. Because I didn't have anything planned that week. I didn't. So if I got joint pain, if my face broke out, if whatever happened, like I could deal with it. And I think that that's not something that I would want to do when I'm trying to enjoy life. And so we think of food restriction as a restriction, then that's what it's going to be. But when you think of it as an opportunity to enjoy high-end foods, which is what paleo is, like you can go and you can get a steak and you can get a Caesar salad without croutons and you can eat foods that aren't necessarily going to trigger your immune system, whatever they might be. I mean, maybe you can't have eggs and then you can't have a Caesar salad, but I think for me, I try to think of things in the context of like when my body can handle it. And when your body is already fighting with something else, that wouldn't be the time that I would recommend adding in an additional stressor on your body. So I hope that maybe that is motivation to find things to enjoy that won't inflame you. I know we're going to talk about it from the perspective of celiac and or non-celiac and the long-term health effects of that, but I didn't want to like just leave that dangling chad hanging because while I don't disagree with you, and I think certainly everybody make the choices that feel good to you long-term. Like I am a huge advocate of this needs to be sustainable for you. And if you're going to go off the rails, if you don't have a beer and that beer is going to be the thing that, you know, keeps you sustained and you're healthy and you don't have issues. You know, you don't have autoimmune, you don't have blah, 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 blah. And, you know, if you get a tummy ache, you're at home the next day and it's not a big deal. Like by all means, enjoy it and don't worry about it. But I just don't want people to set themselves up for feeling frustrated or feeling like they made the wrong choice, because then that's where the guilt and all the kind of snowball problems come in.
Yeah, I actually want to even further sort of reinforce one of the things that you mentioned, which is that symptoms of a reaction to gluten can be what are sort of called distal symptoms, which means it's not at the site of gluten digestion. So certainly, you know, I'm about to talk about increased intestinal permeability, or more colloquially, leaky gut in response to gluten, and who that affects. But we can, there's a lot of things that can be happening in terms of our responses to gluten. So there's the zonulin response, which I'm about to talk about, but there's also antibody responses, which can be an allergy, but it can also be an intolerance. Gluten is inflammatory in all of us. There's this aspect of gluten impacting our metabolism, which appears to happen in all of us, that doesn't require a genetic predisposition. So there's ways that our bodies are responding to gluten that is insidious and can cause symptoms that you might not be necessarily attributing. It might be like, well, I felt fine when I ate it, or I only had a mild tummy ache when I ate it, so it's not that bad for me. But meanwhile, if you're struggling with other health issues, gluten may be the culprit. And having a really critical look at the role that even occasional gluten consumption is playing in your diet is really, really important. So I really want to reinforce that aspect of what you said. Also, I kind of want to clarify that the difference between somebody who can tolerate occasional or even semi-regular gluten consumption versus those of us who can't touch gluten with a 10-foot pole, the difference isn't necessarily in the magnitude. I mean, it is a little bit in the magnitude of our responses to gluten, but it's not that people who can tolerate it are fine, that those things don't happen in their bodies. There's a little bit of a difference in terms of like how much of it happens in our bodies versus theirs. And there's also a big difference in terms of how quickly they recover, how quickly they bounce back. So when gluten or other compounds in wheat are damaging the cells that form the gut barrier, some people have a, you know, better ability to replenish those gut cells than others. And that can relate to a variety of different factors. So it's a little bit about the magnitude of the reaction. It's also a lot about recovery time. And it's important to sort of emphasize, that these compounds that are in wheat, you know, gluten, wheat germ gluten, and ATIs, saponins, they're problematic in everybody. It's just that there's a subset of the population in which they are extremely problematic. And one of those subsets, besides people who form antibodies against gluten, is people with HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8. So approximately 97% of celiac disease sufferers have one or both of these gene variants of the human leukocyte antigen gene. And what's really interesting about these genes is that they relate to zonulin production. So zonulin is it used to be considered sort of an inert precursor that our body made. So we have a lot of processes in our body. Insulin is a really good example. We make something called proinsulin so that when we eat sugar, it's quickly sort of cleaved in two, and it's cleaved into something called C-peptide and then active insulin. And it used to be believed that C-peptide didn't do much, but now we know it does. And insulin, of course, is very well understood that it helps, you know, shuttle glucose into cells and all this good stuff. Zonulin is a sort of a similar molecule to proinsulin. It's a precursor molecule. It's a precursor for something called haptoglobin 2, which is an important sort of spring cleaning of the blood type protein. That's what its function is. So it helps helps to sort of clean up various aspects of, you know, hemoglobin, things like that that are, you know, needing to be recycled. So that's what this particular enzyme does. So it used to be thought that zonulin didn't really have much of a function, but we know now that zonulin is released by the cells that form the gut barrier in the small intestine called enterocytes when we eat gluten. And I really want to emphasize that zonulin is released in response to gluten production in everyone. And then zonulin has this really interesting effect on the tight junctions between the gut epithelial cells, the enterocytes. So tight junctions are these really interesting structures that help glue cells together, but they're regulated. They can sort of open and close, and then it can create a space in between cells in which things can leak into the body. So what zonulin does is it opens up the tight junctions between enterocytes. So that increases intestinal permeability. So it allows things that are inside the intestine that shouldn't be getting into the body, get into the body. And the major difference between somebody with celiac disease and everybody else is that someone with celiac has this very exaggerated zonulin release in response to gluten consumption. And it's one of the main drivers of the pathology of celiac disease, is this very dramatically increased intestinal permeability, which means you're getting all kinds of toxins, bacterial proteins, potentially infectious agents, things that should be eliminated from the body that aren't, like excess hormones. Those are all leaking back into the body. Inside the gut is about 80% of our immune system. So as things leak in, they hit the immune system that's sort of right there as a sentinel and drives systemic inflammation. So it drives body-wide inflammation, and this can be a main driver of all chronic illness. So the difference between somebody with celiac disease and everyone else is how much zonulin is produced. So this goes back to one of the big differences between somebody who tolerates gluten and someone who doesn't is the magnitude of the reaction. So someone with HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ8 and celiac disease is going to have a greater zonulin release, so a greater response to gluten consumption. What's really interesting is that there have been recent studies showing that at least in people with irritable bowel syndrome, so some kind of GI symptoms, that if they have HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ8 and not celiac disease, they still have this exaggerated release of zonulin that opens up tight junctions and increases intestinal permeability. So it causes a leaky gut in response to gluten. So it appears, you know, there we still need some studies that look at more general populations, but it appears as though this exaggerated release of zonulin is linked to HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8 and may happen in everybody who has one or both of those genes. So the big question is, what percentage of us is that? Well, studies, it's different in different regions of the world, so it's different in different cultural backgrounds. But in North Americans, it's upwards of 55% of us. So that implies that upwards of 55% of us have this leaky gut response to consuming gluten, which drives inflammation and health problems. So, you know, while I'm not dogmatic about everyone needing to avoid gluten all the time forever, I think the science is pretty conclusive that this approximately 55% of us with this with these celiac risk genes, right, this genetic susceptibility to celiac disease, and by the way, those genes also predispose to a couple other big autoimmune diseases like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, like Sjogren's syndrome. So like they're not just celiac disease risk genes, rheumatoid arthritis. They also are linked to other sort of high frequency autoimmune diseases as well. The science really looks like anybody with those genes is going to have health problems associated with gluten consumption related to this exaggerated release of zonulin that causes a leaky gut. So I can tell you that with my genetic testing, that is one of the many reasons. I mean, also vomiting for hours after gluten exposure, also another reason. But even if I was asymptomatic, those results, seeing that HLA-DQ2 or HLA, it's DQ2 in my case, but or HLA-DQ8, that is enough for me to swear off gluten for my entire life. I think the scientific evidence is really strong that there's probably other people who also need to avoid gluten, but this particular subset of people, we actually understand the mechanisms behind how gluten can erode our health. So that being said, Stacy, how do you do gluten-free 100% all the time with your family?
Well, you avoid Frappuccinos, first of all.
Hang on. Frappuccinos have gluten?
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously. Frappuccinos?
I can tell that there's sarcasm there, but it's getting late in the night.
No, I really didn't realize that Frappuccinos had
really?
Gluten.
You don't know that that's what put me into anaphylactic shock?
I did not realize it was a Frappuccino.
Oh, I was like, did I not say what it was? Because I was trying to be polite.
You didn't say.
So, yeah, totally. It does. And it's straight up on the website listed in the ingredient list, which I just made a terrible assumption about, which is why I wasn't trying to like...
Yeah, no,
I just... Negatively talk about the brand because it's my fault because I didn't read the ingredients, but... that was meant to be a joke that everybody got. Clearly not the case.
well, one person didn't get it. Maybe all of our listeners did, and they're all laughing at my ignorance.
That's all right. So that said, read ingredients, first of all. I think there have been plenty of instances, and I'm sure everybody who's listening, life, when you're at a restaurant and you ask a waiter or waitress the question about what's in something, and they give you that, like, half response. They're not fully sure, but they're not looking into it, or they'll say something like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I've had to learn to be really assertive. I'm not going to say aggressive, but I had to learn to be really assertive with eating out and saying, could you please go check on that? I need to ask the chef, or if it was coming from a bag or pre-made and they're like, well, we don't make it in-house, so we can't tell you. I ask them, would you mind please go and check the bag or the box that it came in? I ask about how things are prepared as well. That's not so much an issue for people who don't have a super sensitivity like I do, but when things are in a shared fryer or they're prepared on the same surface as other foods, for example, pizza, if the countertop is dusted with flour for the regular pizza, obviously my gluten-free pizza can't go on top of the surface where the flour is. So I ask a lot of questions like that. And I think the other thing is being prepared, because there's sometimes, and it's less and less these days than it was 8 years ago when I first went gluten-free, almost 8 years, but I have learned now to pack protein and utilize a lot of the brands and snacks that are available in airtight bags that keep the food protected for so long. You don't have to have a fridge. You don't have to do all that kind of stuff. I mean, for the cruise, we actually did a blog post last week or 2 weeks ago. But today, on the foods that we were taking, and it's things like RX bars, beef jerky, meat sticks, like Rome sticks and chomps are actually the boys' favorites. We're taking power balls and Epic Pork Rinds, because they're all low sugar, high protein. We can find fresh fruit. We can find different kinds of things like that. But what we usually need is protein, because that can be hard to find if it doesn't have a bun on it, or, you know, whatever the case may be on pre-prepared foods. So, or a like when you go to the deli, all of the food is pre-prepared already on the bread. Well, I can't do that. So it's thinking ahead and making sure that you never get to that phase where you're so desperate and hangry that you just give in to something because it's, you need sustenance. And so I keep foods like that in my purse, in my glove box, in our travel bags, all that kind of stuff, to make sure that when someone is hungry, they don't have to get to that desperate state. And I think the other thing too is researching where you're going and what you're doing. So before I travel anywhere, I actually research restaurants and make reservations if necessary. And I learn the best places that are gluten-free. It's really easy to do these days. You can just like gluten-free restaurant Chicago, and it'll bring up, you know, at least a dozen websites that are dedicated to reviewing gluten-free restaurants and people leaving reviews on the type of service they got, or, you know, the preparation methods and all different kinds of stuff like that. That's really helpful. And for the cruise, and when I travel in an airplane and any place where someone's going to be feeding me a meal and I don't really have a lot of control, I always make sure to mark my food intolerances. So for me, that's gluten, corn, and nightshades. And I put in parentheses for nightshades, peppers, and tomatoes, because those are the ones that are commonly found in things that are the most problematic for me, and most people don't know what nightshades are. So that way I'm even like spelling it out really clearly for them. Right. So I think those are kind of the biggest things to success, and I know that it can feel really overwhelming in the beginning. It's a lot to take on. It can feel embarrassing. I know when you're at a restaurant and the chef comes out and is talking to you about preparing something special for you, like, it can feel a little embarrassing, like everybody is looking at you. But I will tell you that on the opposite side of that coin, when I go out to lunch with my dad, or when I traveled with my dad on the cruise, my dad was like, I love eating with you because we get such great service and the chef comes out and your food's always great. You know, so at least what you're feeling, the stress and the pressure, if you can find a positive spin on it and just relax and say, this is what you need to do to feel your best and to enjoy your travels or whatever the case may be, I think it's really important.
Well, and I think also cooking at home, there are so many different options. I mean, we advocate on the show, because we talk about nutrient density a lot, of replacing grain-based products with more vegetables, some fruit, nuts, seeds, healthy fats, you know, a bigger portion of, you know, seafood or meat. And you're going to win on the nutrient front every single time. And this is something that we've talked about on the show a ton of times. But even when it comes to, you know, favorite gluten-y staples, there's gluten-free versions of everything. They're not all made with great ingredients. You know, a slice of bread is still empty calories, even if it's gluten-free. But there are just like really tasty, convenient options now. So if that becomes a transition food, or a, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the idea of like, if I could just have a beer once in a while, I can do everything else. When there's a really good incentive to be gluten-free, if I can just have like a gluten-free sandwich once in a while, I can do everything else. Like, we all kind of have this currency food, which is what I like to call it. So like the food that if we can just have that one food, everything else seems easier. And like, for me, it's, you know, like chocolate and coffee, right? Like they're still have, you know, some great antioxidants and some good, you know, nutritive value there. But you know, for somebody who's sort of new to this idea of gluten-free, working towards maybe a paleo diet, if your currency food right now is, you know, a grilled cheese sandwich on gluten-free bread on Sundays for lunch, like then that's your currency food, if that makes everything else easier. So, you know, I think we also talked a little bit last week about sort of cutting ourselves some slack a little bit. We've talked on this show before. I think, you know, when there's a line that we can't cross, like I will not consume gluten, wherever we can cut ourselves a little bit of slack elsewhere can really make a big difference in terms of finding sustainability. Like the whole idea is that this becomes natural and easy, and we're testament to the fact that it does get there. That we troubleshoot, okay, what am I going to eat instead of this? And then we've solved those problems. And then eventually it's just like, oh yeah, this is just how I eat now. And ha ha ha, I used to not eat this way. So I think it's sort of important to sort of emphasize that it does require commitment to sort of get through that learning curve. But there's so many tools now that there weren't even 5 years ago for going gluten-free and using some of these gluten-free products as transition foods while you get used to, you know, replacing those things with just different meals, right? Different meals that don't have a gluten component, or doing lettuce wraps, or you know, whatever it is. And so even at home, there's so many different options for delicious foods that don't contain gluten.
Yep. I like the idea of what you call a currency food, because even if it's not gluten, there are some people that are like, well, I've heard great things about paleo, but I can't give up my Diet Coke, or, but I can't give up the cream in my coffee. We'll just do everything else then. Like, think about how much, you know, like you're 99.9% of the way there. Think about how much better off you'll be. So
what I tell my AI peers is you can always kick the can on that one food. So you can always, if you're not seeing the results that you expected, you can always address that one thing later once this whole other thing seems like, if Diet Coke, I mean, Diet Coke's not doing anybody any favors, let's face it. But if Diet Coke is what allows you to do everything else, leave it in for now. And then like in a month or 2 months or 3 months, maybe try reducing your Diet Coke consumption. Maybe see if you like some other, you know, like a live soda that tastes like, pop. Like there's some great live soda flavors that taste like, you know, root beer, Dr. Pepper, like maybe try one of those. You know, find a substitute or alternative and see if maybe then you can feel even better. But like, get everything else down first and then address your currency food. You can, that there's not, it's not a race. There's not a, I have to completely change everything that I eat today or the tortoise wins. It's not a thing.
And with that, mic drop.
The tortoise wins. Woohoo!
Well, I hope that this was helpful for everyone, not just the nuance of people who have the particular health markers of the question being asked. But I think it's one of the things we all struggle with regularly. And I just would encourage and remind everyone to actively try to frame your mindset around the things that are positive and helpful for you, and framing it in the mindset of the choices that you're making and why you're making them. I mean, for me, this was about being there for my family long term and wanting to feel better, wanting to have more energy to, you know, not literally come home from work and need to lie down on the sofa and eat my meal there and not be able to have energy with the family. And so sometimes I get caught up in, you know, bigger things that happen or what my brain is telling me should be the case. And I have to remind myself that none of that is real. That's all just my own personal opinions. And that I continue to focus on my health and what my body feels best with, and be grateful for how much energy I have to do multiple hours of podcasting and getting ready for a super active trip with my family and getting to play with them. And, you know, we actually had in-laws over for dinner before this marathon podcasting session. So my energy levels are clearly in a different place. And I think that's the thing, is you have to focus on what your purpose is and continue to tell yourself that that's why you're choosing to make the choice, because anybody could choose to go to the store and get a little ho-ho and eat it, you know, or like whatever your like food is that's just like on the bottom of the totem pole for you. Like that's the food for me, right? It's like, I remember eating those as a teenager, like saving up my quarters and eating them until I had to purge them. Like, let's just, I'm getting into negative space now. That's supposed to be wrapping up, not derailing. I'm going to bring it back around. But what I'm saying is that the more you focus on what is happening and avoid what you're feeling like you're missing or whatever it is that you think is going to be this thing for you, whether it's gluten or, you know, like you said, Diet Coke or whatever. I just feel like when we focus on the outcome, when we focus on our purpose, it makes the decision to do those things so much easier.
Definitely. Well, have a great trip.
Thanks.
I'm excited to see you in like 2 days.
I'll see you in a couple days. And I mean, by then I'm sure you'll have an Easter menu picked out.
I think we nailed it down at the top of the show. I think we got it.
Sweet.
Yeah. I'm going to try to figure out how to make a ambrosia salad. So
we can help. It's one of Matt's favorite foods. So I'm sure
we have to make it dairy free.
No, you can get like coconut milk, yogurt or sour cream or something like that.
Mm-hmm. We get the best locally made coconut milk kefir. That's like super thick here. So perfect. That's going to work perfectly.
Perfect. That's all you need. And you can make homemade marshmallows and, you know, shredded coconut that's not sweetened. We actually have a recipe on the blog, but like you don't even need a recipe.
Made it easy for me. I will find your recipe and make it.
All right. Well, all of you who are not in a time warp, I hope that you, if you're having a spring break or having a wonderful time enjoying your vacation and hopefully feeling your best, or if not, don't beat yourself up. You'll get back in the groove when you're ready and just relax and enjoy your time away, or at home if you're having a little staycation with family, or if you're not able to take off. I'm with you. I'm making a little heart symbol with my hands, and I'm hoping that you get some time in the future.
I'm gonna give jazz hands just because they're not appropriate right now, but I'm just doing them anyways.
All right, heart hands and jazz hands out. Have a wonderful week, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Would you like curse like a sailor at work and like everybody claps? Then they applause and go, woo, Stacey.
There's not really applause in the meeting rooms. But there's definite, like, head nods and, like, yeah.
Yeah, that was beep, 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 beep.
Yeah, that's exactly. It. Like, thank you for giving that person what they needed to hear.
I someday want to be a fly on the wall when you run a meeting. I don't want to be the person you're swearing at. That would be scary. I would cry. I would be like, no, Stacey, don't yell at.
Okay, so this is...
a great conversation for bloopers.
This right now that I'm going to tell you, Matt is going to love having in the bloopers. And I don't think
this show is going to have the most epic bloopers we've had in like months. Cause it'd be like 5 minutes of bloopers now. It's okay. Okay. It's great.
I don't think I've ever told you this story before, but years ago when I was in my early 20s and I was a manager, I was like running my own department. And my dad came to pick me up for lunch one day, and I was standing in the lobby of the building, and he could see me, and there was a heated exchange between an older gentleman and myself, and he could tell from the way, like our body language or whatever, that it was not a friendly conversation. And I got in the car, and he proceeded to lecture me on needing to be respectful of people or I was going to have issues with my job. And I said, Dad, that guy works for me. And I was chewing him out. Oh, that's one of my favorites.
He was so worried that you were like being rude to your boss.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, That's a little assumey right there.
I know, and I give him a hard time about it all the time. And so don't you worry, I've sufficiently chastised him for that assumption, and he hasn't made it again. So,
I mean, I just assume that you are the boss in every situation in your life.
not always, but it's pretty frequent. I'm not used to being told what to do, but there are a couple people in my company that when they say they made a decision, I listen and I act. We all have our roles to play, so.